Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you. It's A Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, things to think about. A little while ago, I had a very interesting experience. A little while ago, may have been many years ago. It was on Princeton University lawn. Princeton, Association for Humanistic Psychology, they had 2,000 people attending a conference. Now get this, 2,000 people show up, they go to this main hall, and from there they have to go to the opening ceremony. Now what's the difficulty? The opening ceremony is 2.2 miles away from the main hall. Now that's not so bad. Why would 2,000 people want to walk 2.2 miles? Because there's no transportation, and what's worse, it's 102 degree weather. Middle of July. What's going to get 2,000 people to walk 2.2 miles in 102 degree weather at Princeton University? Well, they gave me the job. They said, Armand, could you get 2,000 people to walk this thing? And I went to a number of people and I said, here's what we've got to do. I want all the therapists, the well-known, the best names, the people who are running the workshops to cooperate with me, and we're going to give something to people to grace their way, and we presented a kind of a parade. It was a wonderful thing. We just kind of ushered people along these 2.2 miles, serving them with water sprays and serving them grapes and giving them tumblers and jokes and things. Alana Rubenfeld was there. Was a number of great people along the way, the best of which was an old associate of mine, Al Pesso. Al and Diane Boyden Pesso. Diane Boyden Pesso, fabulous lady. Al Pesso, fabulous man. Terrific people. These two people were dancers turned into, they had discovered something about people, and they were demonstrating it and showing it, and it was remarkable, remarkable addition to my repertoire of therapeutic tools. So Al and Diane Pesso, fabulous stuff. And I just recently ran into Al Pesso again. He's doing a workshop here in New York, and I called him up and we spoke, and he told me about his work, his current work. And he told me that his best representative in New York is Portia Franklin. So I called Portia Franklin and I said, Portia, I want to talk to you about this because I don't think the tools that are available through psychomotor, which is what it's called, psychomotor therapy, are available. And these tools are very important because there's a bottom line to this. There's a bottom line to how you're married, how you're related, who you choose for your relationship, what happens. We have some bottom line and we've got some great tools. I'd like to introduce you, my friends, to Portia Franklin, who's right here in New York. Hi, Portia.
Hi, Armand. Glad to be here.
People should also know that you used to be a broadcaster.
A million and a half years ago, I used to be an independent radio producer. And I did some stuff, in fact, for this station, for WBAI. So
for WBAI.
Long ago and far away.
You worked for BAI yourself, and you did some programming here, and you worked for NPR, I believe.
Yeah, I did some work for NPR, right.
All right. Now, here's the secret. What is that?
Well, here's what the thought that you thought your listeners might really like to start with, and I think it's a good one, which is a lot of people are running around getting into lousy relationships and screwing up adult relationships and screwing up marriages because they're trying to get their childhood needs met by an adult here and now, and doesn't work.
Getting your childhood needs met by an adult in the here and now. Now, what could that possibly be? What childhood needs can you have? Change your diaper? You're going to have somebody feed you? What are your childhood needs?
Well, you know, there are five of them that come to mind, and there probably are lots more than five. But if you look at the five basic ones, you have a sense of place, like you fit somewhere in the world. A child needs place. A child needs support. A child needs nurturance. A child needs protection, and a child needs loving limits.
Oof.
And we don't get all that, and we are in trouble.
Let's start there.
Okay.
Dear my friends, what does a child need, and what do adults need that comes out of childhood that may have never been satisfied? A sense of place. You mean they belong somewhere?
I mean they belong somewhere. I mean anywhere I hang my hat is home, because I take that sense of belonging with me because I had it when I was young.
You, my friends, do you have a sense of place? Do you have a sense of a place you belong? That's one. And what Portia would say, and her cronies, would say, hey, you know, if you don't have a sense of place and there's a childhood need there, and you may wind up choosing a partner just because they got a nice place, you know, because they have a nest where you could stay, and you say, ah, now I've got a sense of place. So you're choosing a partner who is trying to provide your childhood need. We're going to talk about why that's never really successful. The other thing a child needs, number two, first is place, second is win, and third is show. No, second is is support.
Well, I don't know if we're doing these in priority order. They're all important, but maybe nurturance should be next in line because nurturance is pretty big. And you don't get nurturance, you're in trouble in the sense that you try to get, you know, you get people get into substance abuse, people get into trying to overeat, people get into smoking or gambling, and people might try to get from their partner what their partner can't give.
In other words, if you don't get that real breast when you're a kid, you're going to be attracted to boobs later.
No. That may be part of the picture.
It may be why we sell them. No, but the truth of it is, if you don't get nurturance, I spoke to a man earlier today when I was talking to him about his father in France. He said, my father was there. And he said, no, fathers don't nurture. Of course fathers nurture. If you don't feel the nurturance from your father and your mother, and you don't feel that nurturance, if they don't feed you, not only symbolically, figuratively, but literally as well.
Exactly.
You're going to wind up hoping that that's going to happen in your adult life and that somebody's going to give it to you. Somebody's going to give you the thing that's going to make you feel filled.
And you'll never feel filled. So that the partner role will always disappoint, because you're talking about what happens between husbands and wives and partners.
We're going to talk about why it doesn't work later.
Okay.
But let's talk about what the need is. The need is nurturance. We have one of place, the other is nurturance. A third is support.
Support.
What is support? I mean, support is...
Support is, in a real literal sense, you got something under you and you're not going to fall through space, you know? And when people don't get enough of it, they often... For one thing, have dreams. You know that dream that people report a lot of falling endlessly through space and kind of thing? That's a support issue, where it just feels like there's nothing solid under you to go around in the world.
We all need something to lean on, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
We got to have something to lean on. I got to write that in a license plate. We all need something to lean on. Right? Need something to be able to depend on. And if we're going to get it from each other, we're going to get it from family. But, you know, if you grow up not having support in your life, you always feel like you're falling over. And
that's
you could
right.
break.
That's right. And not only do you always feel like you're falling over, but people that have big support issues tend to hurt their legs a lot. They tend to fall a lot. They tend to have, even if they're graceful people, it gets lived out in the body.
We're going to get to that because this is now you're beginning to see the emergence of the thought that comes from Al and Diane Boyden-Pesso's work.
Exactly.
Which had to come from dance.
Exactly.
From dance. We'll talk about that. So the three basic needs so far, place, support, nurturance, the other two?
Protection. Uh-huh. You want to look at the consequences if you don't get enough protection. There's a heightened sense of vulnerability. But there's also another consequence of that. That people walk around the world with a lot, and which is sometimes unwittingly, when there hasn't been protection, there's a kind of an openness that's too open and that causes them more harm to come in future in their lives.
So people who grew up without protection sometimes are more vulnerable, and other people are so closed that they're impregnable.
You can go either way. That's exactly right.
And the last.
And the last is loving limits. And something real important to say here is limits are not some acculturation, something that culture imposes. They're a need, like air. And kids know it when they get it. And if they don't get it, and people out there listening probably know all kinds of people in their lives like this, they're either acting out all over the place or they're so restrained and it makes that they can't put themselves out in the world at all. So you get extremes. On
loving limits. Daddy, can I borrow your submachine gun?
Absolutely not, is the answer to that.
Loving limits.
Yeah, loving limits indeed.
But they don't do, you know, in certain parts of the world, of course, Daddy would say, sure, kid, you know.
I don't think loving limits are a concept in those particular places right now.
Loving limits is being able to say to somebody, you know, I'm going to stop you from hurting yourself. If you're going to put your hand in the fire, I'm going to pull your hand away. You know, if you're going to be playing with broken glass, I'm going to stop you from doing that. Loving limits is being able to determine for the sake of the other person what the limits are.
Yes, but it's not only limits in terms of I won't let you hurt yourself. That's half of it. I won't let you hurt anybody else either.
Mm-hmm.
So you know where you end and the rest of the world begins. So that's it goes both directions.
My guest is Portia Franklin. She's a psychotherapist in New York. Her primary work is called Psychomotor Work, based on the work of Eyal Peso and Diane Boyden Peso. This work grew out of dance, which we're going to talk about. And for many, many years, Al has been working this and developing it. I've been to a number of his workshops where you just see the most dynamic transformations taking place. I'm hoping that we could share some of these tools with you people so that you could use them in your own life in some way, or at least be aware of them. The beginning premise here is that there are five basic needs that every child has. If those needs aren't met, the absence of them is going to manifest in your adult life, and you're going to be looking for the adult partner that you have, or your choice of relationship, or sometimes you even look for your children to serve your childhood needs.
Exactly.
If you're looking to do that, it can't work. It just can't work. What you've got to do is deal with those needs way back then, but we're going to get to how that's done. So you've got an awareness of your basic needs, and I'm sure many of you are asking yourselves, do I feel this sense of place? Do you have a place you belong? Do you feel like you have a place you belong? Do you know where you belong? Do you get the support that you think you need? How about nurturance? Are you being fed in a way that you think you need to be fed? What are the other two?
Oh, sense of place, protection, nurturance,
yeah,
support,
protection. Protection's
limits.
Important, you know? If the stuff hits the fan, is there somebody there who's going to be there for you?
And do you have a sense of strength inside you, so that you're not always looking from it to come from an external mm-hmm. source? Because this stuff gets, first it's given in a concrete way, but then you got it inside you and you walk around the world with it.
And then last comes this sense of limits. There are certain limits. There are things I can't do to you, and there are certain things I won't do to myself. And I have this sense of limits that came out of growing up with loving parents who gave me limits in a loving kind of way. I not only accepted them, but I developed my own ability to limit myself so that I could, when I need to, you know, I could forsake an immediate gratification
Absolutely.
For a later goal.
Right.
I could plan for the future.
Yep.
These are the things. Now, let's go back to this work itself. Comes out of dance. How did it come out of dance? Was it Al Peso himself, or was it Al and Diane?
It was Al and Diane Boyden Peso together, who were both dancers. And early on in the late 50s, Al was working with Martha Graham many years ago. And he started working with dancers in an improvisational way to see what would happen. And one of the things they looked at was they looked at the fact there are three different ways people can move. Okay, one of them is just reflexively, so there's no emotion there. And another way is just like you make a decision and you move your arm or your leg, no emotion there. But the third one was the pay dirt eventually for the work they invented, and that is emotional movement. And they had the dancers contacting a feeling and then moving with that feeling, expressing whatever came up. And initially that was very cathartic, but then ultimately it was not satisfying.
Okay, let's go back.
Excuse me.
Reflexive movement. You move just as a reflex to something. Right? You get a cough, you turn your head.
No. It means it's what holds you upright in a gravity field. Reflexive movement is if you try to relax every muscle in your body when you're standing upright, something's going to hold you upright.
Reflexive movement is that which is automatically taking over and taking care of you.
Exactly.
So that's totally non-voluntary.
Exactly.
The second is voluntary movement, which is now you want to make a movement and you just move without feeling anything. It's just a movement.
Yeah.
The third is emotional movement. Now describe that again. What is emotional movement?
Let me give you a picture. A dancer contacts rage, let's say, and they start moving with that, and they might be flailing their arms and making sounds and screaming and pounding, and they might want someone to die at the hands of their rage. let's say. And so they're flailing and they're moving and they're all kinds of things. They're having a catharsis, an expression of this rage. But the thing that Al and Diane discovered was that this was not ultimately satisfying. The catharsis, you know, acting out the stuff, left people feeling very dissatisfied. And then they made a really important discovery. And this was all in the context initially of dance improvisation. And that is the feeling that the person was dancing with had a kind of shape. As they moved, it had a shape. And that feeling needed a kind of interaction that would give it satisfaction, or what we now call a counter shape. And when they started doing that, they were in the realm of psychotherapy, and dramatic things started to happen. Memories started to come up. Stories came up. And people got a wonderful sense of satisfaction when the need was met just in movement. Now, we're not talking words
yet. Let me just see if I can catch it up for this moment.
Yeah.
An emotional movement is a movement that reflects a feeling that you have, and it comes through your body, and it gets manifested that way. Emotional movements could be very dramatic. They could be very dramatic if you're feeling angry. You could be screaming. If you feel sad, you could be shivering. You could go all the way deep into these. And what Al and Diane discovered is that it's not satisfying enough to just go through the emotion through your body. Something corrective has to happen.
An interaction has to happen that meets the need.
An interaction has to happen that meets the need, that somewhere inside that cathartic, inside that deep emotional reaction that we all have, there's a childhood need in almost every case that somehow has to be addressed. And unless you address that, you're going to wind up getting angry and rageful, and just next week getting angry and rageful again.
Exactly.
And the following week. Or you're going to get sad and depressed, and next week you get sad and depressed, and next week you get sad and depressed, and you just repeat it. Therapists who believe emotional release is enough would be missing the fact that, no, it's more than that. You've got to be able to knuckle down to that childhood realm. You got to find that childhood need. Pull it out, put it on the table, and you got to dance with it, not just the emotional reaction.
Exactly.
Is that anywhere near accurate?
Yes, it is accurate. In other words, when you're feeling that longing for someone to hold you and love you just the way you should have been held and loved as a kid, when that comes alive in a person, there is something that the body does, because the body has receptivity for making a new memory. The body makes the original memories that really happen. But when the longing is alive in a person, their breathing changes, their body moves, and if just at that moment someone comes in and holds them the way they should have been held back then, in just the way that matches the need, with just the right words, something transformational happens. It's like a new symbolic memory happens that transforms their sense of themselves in the world. And that's what the Pessos really came up with, was this notion of ideal parents who could do that, symbolic parents.
A woman tells me a story. She was always perceived herself as a sexual object to her man friend. She considered she was good for sex. That's all he wanted out of her. She walks in the room to greet him one day, and instead of just, and he knows that she's feeling sensitive, that day he's feeling all of the admiration and love that he really feels for her, and he kisses her a million times all over her face. And she talks about the experience of having this man cherish her instead of grabbing her and throwing her down on the floor, as he usually does. This time he cherishes her, and he kisses her, and he kisses her, and he kisses her, and he kisses her with the love and appreciation that he really feels that he was afraid to manifest, but suddenly, boom, it comes out. Now he's doing this. And she's sitting there reveling in this feeling, this love that she had always wanted to feel but could never feel. And she talks about how for days afterwards she was so deeply depressed. Here she was finally getting from an adult the satisfaction of a childhood need, which she didn't have as a child. She didn't have a parent who ever cherished her. And she finally got it, and it sent her into a deep depression. That, Portia, you're going to say, is because we didn't really address the childhood need.
That's right. And it also has to do with the nature of memory. When something happens now, we make sense of it when something happens now, what's going on? Information comes into your eyes, your ears. You know, you have an experience, right? But till you make sense of that experience, the way you construct some kind of meaning out of it is it goes through all your memory centers. So if this guy is, in your example, he's suddenly cherishing her and loving her, and it's feeling good for a minute, but it's going to go through all the memory centers and it's going to evoke all the pain of times when she was not loved and cherished as she should have been, because that's how the mind works. That's
and
how the
that's,
brain works.
That's one of the important things that many of you should think about. You know, when you sometimes when you get what you want, and you get what you want, it could trigger the worst kind of feelings, because you're getting what you want, but you're getting it too late, and it reminds you of all the times you didn't get it.
That's it.
You know, I always wanted someone to be kind to me, and then he was kind to me, and I felt terrible. You know, and this is because of the memories that go along. Now, part of what I guess is really important is that we must have as a foundation a belief that there are memories that are active, that stay in our mind, that we are, may not be aware of. We may not even remember them. And these memories are called unconscious memories.
Right.
Not like you're punched in the jaw unconscious. Unconscious meaning away from your consciousness. They're not in your conscious mind, but they're there.
And they contour and how you see reality, how you experience other people, and how you experience yourself, and how you behave. It's a subroutine that's running the show.
Hmm.
That's the deal. And in order to make real change, you've got to get to that subroutine, which is unconscious. And the body is the route to that. Quite often.
The body meaning, here we go back to Al and Diane Pesso's work with Martha Graham and the dance movement. They noticed that through movement, they had access to some of these early childhood feelings.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And when there is access, in other words, when the feelings are coming up and people are in enormous pain, let's say remembering a mother who didn't love them or nourish them or nurture them, or a father who was abusive or something like that. When you have a memory, it's not just a thought in the head. It is a physiological state. All feelings are in the body before you know you have them. And when they come alive in the body, that's when you can make some change and have something new come in that should have happened when you were small.
Portia, what do you mean come alive in the body?
I mean when someone is in enormous pain, you'll see a heaving in their chest. Often you'll see people put their own arms around themselves. You'll see people rock just the way young kids rock when they're in pain. We relive the experience. It's a bodily experience. It's not just a words floating through the head. And the body is like, it's, you know, Freud used to say that, talk about dreams being the royal route to the unconscious. But my belief, based on the incredible results of this work and the transformational ability of this work, is that the royal road to the unconscious is through the body. And it can help you get to the core of who you are and what you need.
We're going to get back to that. How to get to this information through the body, which is different than just thinking about it, in just a couple of minutes. Before we do, let's talk about accommodation.
Okay. Okay, accommodation is what the Pessos discovered when they were working with the dancers. And what would happen is, let's say a dancer was dancing from a place of pain, remembering, let's say that she wasn't held as a child or loved as a child. Let's say the dancer is, as she remembers not being held as a child and not being loved, she starts to hold herself. Let's say she puts her arms around herself like this and starts to move with that. If you give her someone else, and we call that an accommodator, a person who we could call a comfort figure or a contact figure, and that person, right at the moment when her body is showing the longing to be held, comes in and holds her just as her body is asking to be held, something marvelous happens. And if you say the words at the moment when the body's receptive, so the memory's alive and the longing is alive, if that accommodator who is there in her service says, if I had been back there then when you were a little child and you were feeling sad like this, I would have held you just like this, just as you need to be held. Right at that moment, you're making a symbolic memory and you're putting it in the place where the three-year-old memories are. And it can shift consciousness, and it can shift perception.
What you're saying is it becomes curative. Let me give an example of
yeah.
it. Part of what an accommodator does is it's somebody who's consciously saying to you, let's work with some of these signals that we have that are going to help you get access to the needs you have that you're carrying around as a child. And this is what a therapist would do. They become accommodators. But I remember one thing in particular that I thought was fantastic. I remember once we were having a dialogue, or we were in one of the groups, and Al and Diane Pesso were leading this group, and there were two people having a dialogue, and one person was symbolically, I'm going to be your brother, and I'm going to have you be my brother. Now, that means you're going to play the role of my brother. And as your brother, I'm going to say things to you I always wanted to say to you. So now people do this. They call it role play. So one brother would say, I was always jealous of you. And the other brother would just sit there and say, oh, okay. And then the first brother would say, and I always thought Mom preferred you more than me. Now, what Al and Diane Pesso added to this was a thing that I learned, which was about impact. What would happen is every time you would say something to someone that was a powerful thing meant to accuse or hurt them in some way or make an impact on them, the person would hit themselves in the chest with their fist, and they would make a grunting sound. It would be a little like this. You know, so you say to this person, I'm mad at you. And you, instead of just sitting there and saying yes, you take it and you show the impact by, boom, you hit yourself across the chest and you say, ooh. Now this thing... What?
We don't really quite do it that way anymore.
Okay, but yeah. We did it that way. Yeah. It was great, and we'll go back to how we may have changed it.
Yeah.
The beauty of it was it showed the need for impact. When someone is speaking to you, there is a need for impact. They want to see the effect of what you're saying on them. How many times is somebody arguing with you or telling you something they're angry about, and you sit there passively like you have no feeling about it? The beauty of this technique, as I learned it, was it showed that you had an impact and that it was making a difference. And a person would actually, the way we would do it is we'd wind up moving across the room and actually cowering where the person was yelling at you, and eventually they'd be yelling at you and screaming at you, and you'd just be showing the impact of these words. Because that was the idea. Why do we scream at people? We scream because we don't believe we're having an impact. You see, why don't we raise our voice? Because we don't believe we're having an impact. One of the things that I got from this that I thought was so valuable was I taught couples that I would work with to show that the person who is talking to you is having an impact on you. Don't hide your feelings. Don't react and squelch their feelings, but show the reaction. Show that you're feeling it. Show that it touches you. If somebody says something that makes you feel bad, cry. You know, show your tears. If someone says something that makes you feel good, show your joy. Don't sit there passively. This was a major contribution made by Al Pesso, I believe, to the whole field. And we're going to get back and talk much more about that with Portia Franklin, who's with us today. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're talking about a thing called psychomotor therapy, but it's really a way, one of those vehicles that could be used in between now and then. We will give you a little music, of course, to cheer you up. Let's see if we can get your bodies moving with this, my friends. And I'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes.
You are listening to The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial.
As frutas levantadas subiram no pau, comeram com casca, comeram a fruta, caroço dela ficou no chão.
Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão.
E as frutas derrotadas subiram no pau, comeram com casca,
comeram a fruta,
caroço dela ficou no chão.
Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão. Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão.
Thank you. chilena exala, exala e a fruta está de vontade. Subiram no pau, comeram com casca. Comeram a fruta, caroço dela ficou no chão.
Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão. Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão.
Zala, zala e a fruta de vontade. Subiram no pau, comeram com casca. Comeram a fruta, caroço dela ficou no chão.
Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão. Comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, comeram a fruta, balaio dela ficou no chão.
Vontade, manga, caju, tambarino, yaraçá, maboque, ai, 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 fruta, fruta,
maçã da Índia, lembra lá lango cajongue, cajonga.
Fica colado, Zé,
colado, Zé,
na cola, Zé.
Fica
colado, Zé,
colado, Zé,
na cola, Zé.
Fica
colado, Zé. Na cola, Zé,
fica
colado, Zé,
colado, Zé,
na cola, Zé,
fica
colado, Zé,
colado, Zé,
na cola, Zé,
fica
colado, Zé,
colado, Zé,
na cola, Zé.
Eat the fruit. Comer la fruta. You thought that was Spanish, didn't you?
I did.
Didn't you? Didn't you? Yeah. This is Bonga from Africa. B-O-N-G-A. And that's Frutas de Ventada. Looks Spanish, but it's really African. It's kind of an interesting thing. So we talk about early childhood stuff and we talk about parenting. Now we talk about the fact that if you get together with a group of people who are working and intending in a group to try to help people get through things, they play different roles for each other. Now, here's where we get the roles of accommodator, perfect parent, you know, ideal parent, stuff like that.
Well, yeah, that's an accommodator is a role player. That's exactly right. And something I wanted to make sure people realize, Armand, is that when people are accommodators in this work, they don't improvise anything. They just respond exactly in a way that corresponds to what the person who's working wants. So there's no improvisation. This is all you're putting out in the room what the person working needs to see. And it's very exact. And it's not, it's only from their mind, not from nobody else's contributes to that. It's very important. So if somebody's playing somebody's ideal brother or ideal mother or ideal father, they don't invent anything because it's all coming from that place inside where people's longings are, and it has to be very specific to their needs and wants.
So give me an example of two people having a dialogue and how you find out. So, I mean, if you say to someone, all right, I'm going to now be your perfect parent for you.
Or your ideal parent.
Or your ideal parent. I'm going to ask you, will you teach me the words of how I would be?
Exactly. The person working will say,
I'm the ideal parent.
Well, let's say I'm.
And I'm going to be the ideal parent with you.
And let's say I had an abusive parent, and maybe the first thing I would ask you to say is, please say to me, if I had been your ideal father when you were a little girl, I would never have hit you or abused you. And then you would say those words.
If I were your ideal parent when you were a little girl, I would have never hit you or abused you.
Yeah. And then the person would be very moved to hear that if they're ready to hear that. And maybe they
even
would say,
even though they told you to say it.
That's what's phenomenal. It's as though we come.
I can get it. I really get it. You know, Dan Malinwood used to have this wonderful exercise where he would tell people to whisper the word. He had people break into groups. This is really phenomenal. Had people break into, they would stand alone. He would have people break into two groups. The one group would be the talkers. The other one would be the listeners. People would be standing alone in the middle of a room. And he'd have all the other people go around and whisper to the person who was standing there. Now, this is the talkers versus the listeners. The talkers would now move around the room and whisper something they always wanted to hear as a child, something they wanted to hear as a child. So if you always wanted to hear, well, you're really my favorite son, right? And you always wanted to hear that, you'd go whisper it to a group of people in the room, but you'd be whispering it even to women. You're always my favorite son. It would somehow, the fact that you were saying it to people made those people all crack with tears, that there seemed to be almost a universal need in here.
There is indeed a universal need. All that stuff is, all those needs we talked about are absolutely universal.
What is it that you, my friend, would have loved to have heard from your ideal parent? Think about it a minute. Just think about it. What is it? What is it that you would have liked to have heard, you know? Can you picture it? Can you get it? What would you like to have had your father or your mother say to you? And they would have meant it. Really meant it. Go ahead, shake your head if you got it. Do you feel it? You can feel, just think the words. What they do in this work is they use each other. They go to the other person and they say, here's what I would have liked my parent to say. Now, would you say those words to me? Give me an example of some of the things that people want to hear ideal parents say.
What's important to know is it will come exact. It will be an exact reversal of whatever wounding their parents did. So if they had a mother who ignored them or a father who was a workaholic, they might want the father to say, I would not have been a workaholic, and I would have been there and paid wonderful attention to you. You would have been the apple of my eye. I would have loved you just the way a father's supposed to love a child and held you just the way a father's supposed to hold a child, or just the way you would have wanted." And it's not a generic thing. It's real important to say this. It's very specific. These are reversals of exact things, exact moments of wounding. And there needs to be an exact reversal. It's like balancing the books in a way.
Well, I think about a patient I saw earlier today. Her father would have said to her, if I were your perfect parent, I would have kept appropriate boundaries. And
yes.
I would have never touched you where I shouldn't touch you.
Yeah, that's a good one. We hear that a lot.
Yeah.
We hear that really a lot. And sometimes what is needed is something that seems so simple, but it's profound because the longing is as old as the person's
life. Like what could seem simple?
Well, maybe just I would have looked at you with loving eyes. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, and sometimes it's a kind of touch that's needed. I remember one woman who was sitting and talking, and her thumbs were going back and forth. You know how people do sometimes for the thumbs?
Twiddle their thumbs.
She was kind of twiddling as she was crying about some negative stuff about her dad. And just when the twiddling started, Al Pesso, who was doing the works, said, I'd like to suggest something. I'd like you to ask one of the men in the room to role play a contact figure who would just meet that thumb the way you're meeting it. So now she's got contact with another person. And in that moment, it was an electric moment. It's just a thumb meeting a thumb. But the meaning of that, the thumbs got very playful, and she started laughing out through her tears. And in that moment, this guy who was accommodating became an ideal father who would have played, known how to play with his little girl without hurting her, because that's the exact reversal. Her father had been a military guy who hurt her every time he hugged her.
We don't want our mates to become ideal parents. We don't want that because that's not going to make a difference. We want our mates to be themselves.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
We want to be able to access an ideal parent so we could learn about our needs and correct our needs.
Maybe I'd say it this way, Armand. We need to know what we'd feel like if ideal parents had been there and given us what we need. We need to walk around in the world with that. Mm-hmm. And then we can love our partners, adult to adult, you know, with real mutuality. We're not looking for a mom or a dad. We're looking for a partner.
I found a man today, a man who was so alone. He was the same one. And he's so alone, he decided he would only be alone in his life. And every time someone came along, he had a string of relationships with women who said, I will love you like nobody's ever loved you. And one after another, after another, after another, turned into a disastrous relationship with, when you asked him, what is it that you need? I want somebody to love me purely. But every time he got it, it wound up destroying it.
So this is not an uncommon picture. And one of the things that people need to be aware of is sometimes the healing that has to happen in someone's life that they need not only symbolically to heal themselves, but their parents and their grandparents. Because sometimes people do what you just talked about, bumping off all the partners, because they played a role that was like a partner role with one of their parents.
This is beginning to sound like the work of Bert Hellinger. What do you mean your parents?
Well,
and
here's what I mean. Well, you have parents that are who are not bonded. Let's say we have a son, a little boy, and we have a mom and a dad who aren't sexually or emotionally bonded. Something's going to happen in the personality of that little kid where he's going to maybe become, or not even maybe, it's almost, it's predictable. He's going to become in certain ways the little partner to his mom. And in a way that's absolutely unconscious, the kid doesn't know he's doing it. And that fact can follow that child all through his life so that he never is available then to bond with an appropriate partner in
because
life.
Because he's married to his mother.
Because he's married to his mother.
Because you
That's
had
exactly
two
right.
parents who weren't bonded, the boy marries his mother, in effect. Or the girl marries her father. Yeah. That also happens.
Right? And it actually can happen both directions with both genders.
Right. Mother could marry her daughter. Her daughter could marry her mother,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, emotionally.
And I am committed. And what you find through the work very often is how come all those relationships didn't work out? Underneath everything, underneath, if you go through the layers, you find people were committed to their parents.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not so stupid when you think about it, because I can't tell you the number of dysfunctional mothers I've seen or heard of walking around carrying a baby, and when they're emotionally distressed saying to the baby, you know, I'm the only one who will ever love you. Don't ever let anybody else love you. Because when they think the child can't hear it or is not going to remember it, they drive these memories into the child's brain. And there's a child who is being told as an infant words such as nobody will ever love you the way I do. Well, what do you expect is going to happen when they grow up? Psychomotor work, most great therapies will help uncover that psychological mandate, you know,
yes,
if you get to it.
And reverse it.
And reverse it. That's why, you know, simple behavior modification doesn't work.
It doesn't. No, I agree that it doesn't. Look, we are operating from so many layers of unconscious stuff that we don't see. But that affects what we do, what we don't do, who we love, who we don't love, how we respond to other people, how we let them respond to us. And unless we get at that unconscious stuff, which is really, you know, the body's one very good way to do that, following what the body asks for, we are doomed in a way. You know, the history that isn't understood in a certain way is doomed to be repeated in one form or another.
With learning a little about yourself, is that it's very hard. You believe it's very hard to do this work on your own, don't you?
I know that it's very hard to do this work on your own, but that doesn't mean you can't get certain awarenesses from tuning into your own body once you realize your body's full of information. I think in terms of doing the healing work and feeling what you'd feel like with all the early needs met that maybe weren't met, that takes a group and that takes the work. But being aware that if you follow what's going on inside you and you tune in, you might learn something about where your heart really is or where your feelings really are, that's something that anybody can do.
How do you account for Portia, though? I mean, the thing that you probably leave out, I think, is how do you account for something like a hormonal shift that's creating an emotional kind of mandate? Do you believe that everybody with PMS, therefore, has some early childhood need that's coming out? Or do you believe sometimes a drop in serotonin or an increase in dopamine? So now, let's say we get somebody who gets a hormonal, let's say it's menopause.
Hey, I can speak to that very authoritatively.
Okay, a lot of people around menopause want to change their name from their husband's names to their own individual names. A lot of people have these needs of wanting to give birth to something of their own.
You know something, Armand? It would be simplistic to say that everything is anything. There are a multitude of factors that make us who we are, bottom line. Some of them are hormonal, for real. As I said, I'm very authoritative on that particular experience.
You've been through it, right?
Personally speaking. However.
But now, wait. Since you've been through it, let's talk about it for a minute. Since you've been through it, and since you're a very sane lady, and I'm a very sane person, and I clearly would rather have you on the island of survivors than almost anybody I know. You're there, you're conscious, you're aware, you're joyful, you're a nice person. But now you go through this tremor inside your body. You got hot flashes taking place. You've got to eat air conditioners. You know, you've got this stuff is happening. And emotional needs that look like they are real taking place. Now, are you going to say that all that you went through is absolutely solidly reflecting an early childhood conflict?
Of course not. Of course not. But here's what I would say.
Okay.
Here's what I would say. What I will do with that hormonal stuff that flies around and how I will manage it and how I will experience it is going to have a lot to do with who I am and who I come into it with. And that has to do with my history. So you've always got the hormones. You've got a biochemical machine here. You've got history affecting the development of the person. You've always got a combination of biochemistry, hormones, and history impacting in such a way that in a given moment in time, you're going to feel a certain thing or do a certain thing. It's all working together. And you want to understand all of that. I mean, what I did was, you know, I went to my nearest physician, and I got some hormonal help is what I did. But certainly you're going to be more volatile with hormonal shifts. That's real. It's definitely hormonal. But if you have a pretty strong sense of self and you're a reasonably healthy, sane person, you're not going to go too over the top.
And going over the top is to completely deny that there's any cause taking place that may be inside you, that it may be you, even though it points to the outside like crazy.
Always both.
Menopause is like saying, you know, the enemy is out there.
Oh, well, the enemy is in there.
And the trouble is, somewhere you got to have the consciousness to say, well, maybe I'm going through something inside me. But what's interesting is when you have a human body and you're so tuned into your body as you are, and you're so tuned into movement and the physical manifestation of emotions, then, you know, it just gets validated. Because you feel it, that makes it real, is what people think. I think sometimes emotions are not real. I think they're manufactured. I think they're distractions quite often. And I think it's something that a person can go through that's kind of like an impulse, and it's a moment. And you could either believe it or not believe it.
But what do you mean by not real, exactly?
I think, for example, rage is easy for many people. I know a lot of folks who just rage and anger is a breeze for them. These are people who live on anger. Somebody comes along and says to that person, you know, you look a little tired. Boom, they get rageful because they don't want to be perceived as anything. They don't want to see their own vulnerability. You could believe the rage, and you could go into the anger, and you could talk about the anger all you want. What's really underneath it is vulnerability.
Sure.
And sadness, you know, underneath it.
Of course.
But a lot of therapists would just work with the rage itself.
No. Not at all. In psychomotor, certainly not. Because in general, when you have an overreaction, in other words, when it feels like there's too much rage for what's really happening, there's history underneath. There's the then under the now.
Well, that's important. So whenever you have an overreaction in anything,
look for that.
I knew a woman who broke up with a man, and no, a woman whose father died, actually, and she wore black for 2 years. She couldn't get over it. She was somewhere grieving him for 2 years. We're now saying, well, you've got every right to grieve your father's death, but if you're grieving it for 2 years, there's childhood needs at play here.
Yeah, for real. And we have a term that we use in psychomotor that's a useful one, I think, called magical marriage. A kid that overbonds with a parent, a child who gets enmeshed, too tied up with the parent, too much trying to fix the parent or meet the needs of the parent. Usually that would fit with this kind of situation where someone, once that parent dies, can't function in the world because they were partnered with them in some kind of way.
Even if that person wasn't available, they were partners with them
sure.
in their minds.
Sure, 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 sure. So all that stuff, it's a lot happening from a lot of ages in a given moment in time. I want to give you a wonderful quote of Al Pesso's because I think I love it, and I think your listeners might like it. When we look at what's going on in the here and now and what we react to and what we don't realize it's history that's making us see in a particular way. And Al Pesso has a quote that I like a lot, which says, I hope I'm doing justice to it, but present consciousness, you know, what we're perceiving right now in the room, in the world, is a tapestry woven of threads of memory. And it really is. And what we try to do in psychomotor is unweave some of that or get to the point where it can be rewoven in a symbolic way that makes a person feel better walking around in the world.
Let's say it one more time.
Present consciousness mm-hmm. is a tapestry woven of threads of memory. And when memory has negatively impacted, has really wounded a person, they need new memories that are symbolic, but that meet a need that is as old as their soul, as old as their life. And that's what the work tries to do.
It's fascinating because, you know, in so many ways we'd love to get away from the idea that our past is really going to be responsible. People think they got to blame their parents. You know, Portia, they say, oh, I don't want to blame my parents. I want to forgive them. I want to let them go and so on and so forth. That's all right. You could do that. But to understand that you are reacting not only from the present but from your past, and that your past is affecting you at every moment in your choices, in your beliefs, in the love that you choose, in the conflicts you have, that's the kind of information that I think makes all the difference in the world, the difference between people who can somewhat get through life joyously and the people who can't. My special thanks to Portia Franklin, who's available, and you can reach her through, she's at the Flatiron Building. Learning about yourself is not an easy thing, but it certainly is fruitful and makes life a lot easier. We'll be back with you shortly, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program, you could go to WBAI.org or go to my website, thepositivemind.com. Lots of information on there, all of the archives from previous programs. You can listen to a whole bunch of programs, and you can send me an email, armand@thepositivemind.com. Love to know your responses to the kind of programming we do. Be back with you soon, my friends. Thank you.
Thank you.